Ladies and gentlemen, it's a real privilege and an honor to welcome to the Salary Report Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, who is the U.S. Representative for Ohio's 9th District, which stretches from her hometown of Toledo to Cleveland. She's serving her 17th term in the House of Representatives. She ranks 15 out of 435 members in seniority, and she serves on the all-important House Appropriations Committee. And I must tell you, when anybody tells me that there's nobody doing anything, I always, of course, refute that. But first on my lips is to bring up Congresswoman Kaptur. There's no public servant I have more respect for. So, Congresswoman, again, thank you for joining us on the Salary Report.
Thank you so very much. It's an honor to be on your program, and those of us in public service appreciate the boost.
Well, I know what a grueling job it is, and I'm very grateful that you're in there fighting for all of us. Now, Trans-Pacific Partnership, I know trade agreements is something you know a lot about. You were part of the fight on NAFTA, but you've certainly made an effort to make your voice heard on Trans-Pacific Partnership. If you could just dive in and tell us what is it and what you think of it.
Well, first of all, the subject of trade is vitally important to our country. And I wait for the day when America is able to have more exports going out than imports coming in. And the problem with trade agreements that have been negotiated over the last several decades is they turn out being net negatives for the United States, to the point where last year our gross domestic product was reduced by almost a fifth, where we have seen outsourced production, certainly from districts like mine, literally plants picked up and put someplace else. I'm thinking of Dixon Ticonderoga that made school supplies and crayons, literally picked up out of Sandusky, Ohio, and plunked down in outside of Mexico City. And so I am for trade that results in positive trade balances for the United States, or at worst, just a balance. But to have decade after decade of trillions of dollars of deficit have ended up costing us millions and millions of jobs and lost productivity inside this economy. Now, this new agreement that's called the Trans-Pacific Partnership that was negotiated in secret would actually support many multinational business interests and their agendas to the detriment of local state interests and certainly the interests of those individuals who are working very hard at whatever product or service they're offering. And the agreement is not even, I can't even talk about it publicly. So there's a lot of secrecy that's involved in it, and it's a real overreach, I feel, by the executive branch. And we need to have trade agreements that can result in positive trade balances for our country so our country can grow and our population can have rising incomes, which has been really very ephemeral, very out of reach for the vast majority of Americans as the middle class shrinks.
We published a special report about a month ago on all the information that we could find, which is, of course, limited. And one of the things that struck me is that this is not so much a trade agreement as I think the words I heard when I spoke with your staff, but a treaty, because you're talking about reengineering the relationship between corporations and sovereign governments in a way that I would say is unconstitutional. I can't fathom that this is legal.
I believe it to be unconstitutional and an overreach by the executive branch of its authority, and it's time for the legislative branch to put its 2 feet down and say no more. There are 28 chapters in the agreement, and only 4 actually deal with trade. The rest include chapters that would allow foreign corporations to sue in private tribunals and even sue local, state, and federal government for policies like, for instance, food safety. That could be brought into question, whether or not we could have a U.S. Postal Service brought into question. So really, it is a treaty, and the fact that they want to keep it so secret and not allow us to have full sunlight should cause the American people to question the process by which this is being brought before the Congress itself. It truly has been an overreach by the executive branch for a long time. The last agreement they tried to shove through here, which dealt with Korea, we were promised that we would have, 50,000 cars over there by this time. There's only been a trickle, and we now have a larger trade deficit with Korea. So they're not working as promised.
Now, in terms of the secrecy, which has been, I know, extraordinary, my understanding from your staff is you are allowed to read it, but you're not allowed to have any staff or experts working for you access it or be able to help you understand it. And it's an enormously long, complicated document for one person to read.
Yes, it remains top secret. You have to let them know that you're going to try to read it. They have the document actually in several pieces in a separate room. And then, let's say it's about 1,000 pages long. And I was looking for a particular provision. I won't say what it was. I now know by being down there that it is not in there, and this particular provision was in prior agreements. I believe it's important to the interests of the people of this country. I can't talk about it. And I'm concerned that it is not in this agreement. It took me a long time to figure that out, and I can't even talk to my constituents about it. I mean, this is a really dangerous and irresponsible way to review any agreement that has global implications. And I have introduced a separate bill, a bipartisan bill, along with Duncan Hunter, the lead sponsor from California, to change this, so that any agreement of such significance would be publicly available for 60 days before we vote on it. And the procedure they want to bring it up under is to say, well, first you vote to not allow Congress to amend the agreement, and then we'll let you read it for 60 days. So they want to handcuff us in something called fast track, a procedure. And then we'll be able to talk about it, but yet we can't amend it. What sense does that make?
The reason your proposal is so important is I've had experience with very significant pieces of legislation or regulatory policy, and when you submit them to Sunshine, what you discover always is you made a lot of really bad mistakes. And you end up, it's an organic process, but you end up with something much better. And so to just plop this out, you're going to have some terrible, terrible results. Well, let's talk a little bit about the process. What happens, where is this in terms of congressional response, and what happens next?
All right. Well, there's heavy lobbying going on right now. You see what the president is doing, and there are private interests that are approaching individual members who have not declared how they are going to vote on the process by which the bill will be considered, and then the bill itself. We're being told now maybe it'll come up Thursday this week, maybe it'll come up Friday. What happens in these closing moments is that the entire executive branch and the private interests who negotiated this with no sunlight for the American people, they now go after certain members. You saw where I think four members of Congress just went on Air Force One over to Europe with the president.
Right.
And, this kind of thing goes on to court votes. And who knows what's said to other members on a one-on-one basis. And we are an institution of 435 members. They have a lot of different interests. You know, the executive branch is very big. It has a lot of power, and it controls a lot of resources directly. And so now we're into this heavy lobbying period.
And who's the in the lead as being for this in terms of constituencies? Is it the chamber? Is it the large corporations? Who's pushing this?
Those, I would say, about 500 corporations that do business globally. And I'm for them. I'm for them doing business globally. But it leaves out the American people, the implications of this agreement on their on the rule of law of this country, kind of privatizing litigation on many levels. We don't have a chance publicly to probe and to ask questions. And if you read the agreement, as I have, you'll see there's just a lot of room for interpretation. And the members of Congress weren't invited in to help draft the agreement. but very big banks, very big corporations that can play on the international level. And you know that's a handful. And they already have a lot of power.
Now, we're coming into a presidential election in 2016. Do you think this is going to be an important campaign issue, particularly after, you know, sort of the back and forth about GATT and NAFTA in the last couple of campaigns?
Oh, millions of communities, companies, working families have been hurt by our trade policies. And if you poll the American people, they believe that trade restrictions are more important than unfettered free trade because they know it's not a level playing field when you're competing against a state enterprise, let's say in China, or a state-backed enterprise. And they, a majority, oppose giving the executive branch and the president this kind of authority without any restriction. So the American people have caught on because so many have been harmed.
Yes, I think they know. How do we support you in this? I know I've seen your excellent press release on your position on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What can a citizen do if they're in your district or if they're in any district? What do we do?
Okay. Well, first of all, they should call their member of Congress. They could email them. They could send them a letter. They could call them directly on the phone, either the House or the Senate, and tell them to oppose Fast Track, which is the procedure by which this will be brought up, and also then oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. They could send letters to their local newspaper. They could post and tweet about this on social media and tell their family, their friends, their coworkers to do the same. And if you're connected to an organization, encourage its decision makers to take a strong public position against the fast-track procedure by which Congress is essentially put in lockdown and can't amend, and then against the Trans-Pacific Partnership itself.
Okay, well, I'm going to encourage everyone to do it. I think overriding our national, I think it overrides the Constitution, but the idea that our elected representatives don't have access and their staff don't have access to this with plenty of time to digest, I think is outrageous.
I am subject to criminal prosecution if I talk to you or any of my constituents about anything I've seen or any concern I have about what is in that agreement. What kind of a system does this create?
Well, a system that pumps and dumps the housing market. So I just want to bring up housing. There are two other issues because I know you've got a vote and I don't want to keep you. Two other issues I want to bring up. And one is I just want to compliment you on everything you've done to bring attention to just poor policy in the housing area and everything you've done to really help your constituencies deal with the problems in the housing markets and foreclosures. I know you've done a great deal. So I didn't know if you wanted to just mention any of the things you're focused on now in housing, but I really appreciate the attention you've given to that area.
Oh, I thank you so much because it's the major source of wealth, housing, for the majority of America's families. And the housing crisis for just African-American families wiped out 45% of their accumulated wealth. Can you imagine?
Right. Yes,
you know, families, for Caucasian families, a fifth. I mean, it's breathtaking what happened. So we have been working very, very hard to allow states like Ohio to use what's called hardest hit fund money to remove blighted structures, which are bringing down the value of homes in our region. And that was one of our latest accomplishments regionally. And then I'm working on a bill right now, an amendment that didn't pass, to allow more housing to be constructed for our homeless veterans. We have about 50,000. And unfortunately, that amendment failed on party lines, but I'm going to keep at it. But I also think, and I'll just mention this to you and your listeners, I've been really thinking about how to change the accounting of our student loans. You know, the younger generation can't afford to buy a house because a lot of them are paying off student loans. And from an accounting standpoint, those streams of repayments come back to the federal government.
Right.
And I've been thinking about how do you transform that debt stream into an equity stream? And talking to people at the General Accounting Office and other places about how to think about changing the term or the interest rate over time and allowing some of those dollars to be accumulated in the form of a down payment, almost like the old turnkey program. So if you or your listeners have any interest in that,
I don't suppose there's any possibility of requiring the Fed-guaranteed ones to get the same interest rate, to mark the interest rate to the interest rate at the Fed window, so that the sort of low rates that the banks are getting, the students have to get to. And if you retroactively did it, then that money could then be put in an equity pool for just such a thing.
Write me a paragraph on that.
I will do that.
Write me a paragraph, because it is staggering how much money is moving in this system today, and being paid back to the government of the United States.
Right.
But I almost want to say it's dead money. It isn't creating any productive wealth, and the housing sector is still very sluggish.
Right. Right. And I think if you look, the administration is doing a lot of things. We just did a new post on all the things the administration is doing to support the housing market. But I agree with you, unless you give relief on student loan, you're never going to get this housing market really going.
No. And the young people, they're burdened. What kind of a country would burden its next generation with this kind of debt?
The only country would do it is one that wants to destroy its economy. It makes so from an economic standpoint, it's suicide.
It's just, and I've never seen, since World War II, housing has always led recovery, but not this.
Right. Right. Okay, well, I will write you a paragraph, but I do have to bring up John Oliver's incredible support of your efforts on poultry farming. And I laugh because this is an issue, which I live in Tennessee, and this issue on poultry farming is very near and dear to our hearts. And every time I bring it up, people laugh at me. So I understand what you've been dealing with as you try to get support for the poultry farmers. And so to see John Oliver give you the support you really deserve just had me howling. But maybe if you could talk a little bit about poultry farming and why it's so important.
Well, first of all, I thank John Oliver. He never talked to me, and I didn't was going to write a story about this, but I am so grateful because I've been working on this for 16 years.
Yeah.
And it's the most publicity it's ever got. And
isn't that wonderful?
Oh, it's wonderful. And
we're going to make the John Oliver video the movie of the week on the Salary Report on the week that we publish this, so that will be... You know, for everybody listening, it's right there on the blog post. You can't miss it, and it's unmissable. You got to watch it.
Thank you. And we basically, it would allow those who are raising our poultry in our country not to suffer injustices at the hands of a very few companies. About four control a majority of the market, and they hold all the cards, not even allowing the people who are doing the work and who are financially at risk in this production chain to be able to talk to their members of Congress on such simple things as guaranteeing a fair contract.
Right.
These farmers have a right to speak. They have a right to assemble. If they do that and they try to compare prices with their colleagues or they go to a meeting, they're retaliated against. They are either cut off from production or they are given birds that are less healthy. And I couldn't believe it. I've gone out to some of these operations, and both the individuals raising the animals as well as the integrator, the big company. And I see such a disparate standing for those that they're actually like sharecroppers. They're
right.
Not independent farmers anymore.
Right. And they're living below the poverty line.
Many of them are. And
yeah.
They can, and they assume all the risk, and the company doesn't. The risk is assumed by the grower, not the processor. It's a very unfair relationship. At a minimum, they ought to have the ability to speak out on their own behalf. And let me tell you, they are afraid. No American should be.
Right. Right. I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, to have four companies, the one of the things the video pointed out is that we're now producing about 160 million chickens a year. For that to be consolidated into a quartile of four companies is absurd. And of course, one of the reasons it works is, yeah, they're squeezing the farmer.
They're squeezing the farmer. And now avian flu is setting in all over the country. It has decimated Minnesota's birds, Iowa's birds. And I just got on the news this morning that in Michigan, in Macomb County, Michigan, which is getting very close to Ohio, by the way, where we have a huge industry, they've discovered avian flu. So what happens when all these animals die?
Right.
And who's going to assume the burden of that risk? This is a national problem. I don't know if you've noticed, but the egg prices are going up all over the country. That's because of the devastation in this industry that's occurring.
Well, it's a very unhealthy situation for the food supply, for the farmers, for everybody. So I really appreciate, because I know how hard it is to get people to talk to you seriously about poultry farming, but it's very, very important. So
it's a hard and difficult business, and the farmers have a right to speak, to assemble, to defend their interests without retaliation.
Yes. Well, Congressman Kaptur, I know you have a vote to do, so I won't hold you any longer. I just want to say that I appreciate everything you're doing. I think you make an enormous difference. I have no idea how you get the enormous strength intellectually and physically to go back in and do what you do, but thank God you do.
I represent and I meet in this work, and please mention to your listeners that, you know, there's a photo on our website. And the social media on the Trans-Pacific Partnership where I went down to the reading room and to try to read this agreement and what we had to go through in order to even get in. And so trade transparency is very important. And thousands of people have posted comments on social media related to that and on Facebook. So we encourage people to get in the fight with us.
Okay, well, we're in the fight with you. Let us know what we can do. We'll get that picture. We'll get it tweeted out. We'll get this all up on our site, and I'll send you a paragraph on my idea on student loans, okay?
Thank you so much. Please do.
You have a great day.
You too. Thank you, Catherine.